Welcome to the Coconuts Podcast. Today is September 24th, 2021. The Coconuts Podcast is your home for top trending news and pop culture from all across Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. I'm Summer Lee.
And I'm Andre Nasri.
And I'm not Russian, but damn, do I do a good Russian.
That was good, but thank good you. in the level of, what's her name? Elizabeth Olsen doing that fake Russian accent for her TV show.
First of all, it's Sokovian. Get it straight.
Sokovian, right.
Yes, exactly. Me and her, yeah, we're of the same breed.
She lost that accent along the way, didn't she?
Yeah, kind of. But also, did like, throughout Wonder that? Vision, I don't know. Like, is this something you have to go to classes for? And then because of the pandemic, maybe, like, she couldn't go to those classes. So now she's American. That's my theory. Thank you. This is now a conspiracy theory podcast. Deal with it.
Yes, yes. And speaking of WandaVision, did they win anything at the Emmys?
I don't know. Was there any Disney Plus shows, or is that, you know, just for the big boys and Disney Plus is considered, I don't know, not eligible?
No, I don't think so, see? Because my favorite show of the past year or so, courtesy of Apple TV Plus, Ted Lasso, that won 7 trophies, I think. Yeah. And if you haven't seen it, you don't have to like football or soccer, if you want to call it that. It's just the most heartwarming and at times really funny and really sad at the same time. Like, I could laugh and cry in like one episode. It's just incredible. It's so life affirming. I love it so much. And I'm so glad that it got the recognition that it deserves.
Incredible. I'm sold. I will go and acquire it. Illegally. I meant legally. Wow, there's something in my throat today.
But we'll get tested.
Also, I should. Yeah. We have one of those like ART tests. The government gave us all like 6 per household, so I will probably go and make use of those. Thanks, government. Love you.
Wait, what are ART tests? Can you explain that to me?
You go to test if you have COVID by yourself.
You guys are voluntarily shoving that thing up your nose.
Not at all, no. I wouldn't do that for fun, for sport, maybe for $100. But yeah, I'll let you know when that happens.
Excuse me. See, No, that's not COVID. That's not COVID. Don't worry.
Okay, COVID.
I tested negative.
Thank you very much for telling all of us.
Are you glad that I'm okay? Are you glad that I'm not dead?
No, yes, that's incredible. Thank you so much.
I mean, that's the thing, though. Like, every little thing, like, you get sick with any little thing now. You gotta get your nose fucking swabbed.
You wanna cough in this here pandemic? No.
Exactly. And like,
shoot you dead. No, I'm just kidding.
I get the whole like, you know how people say these days that there's such a thing as nostril virginity?
What the fuck?
Oh, I think I maybe weird friends in my circle say this, but in the beginning of the pandemic, when we first started getting swabbed in the nostrils, it was painful, you know? But I've done it like 10 times, and by the 10th swab, I was like, didn't feel it at all. Like, my nose is used to it.
What an incredible story. How brave of you to share. Thank you so much. I didn't think I would wake up and listen to this story, but damn, am I thankful I'm here listening to this story. Incredible stuff. Thank you, Andra.
Anyway, what are we talking about today?
It was the Emmys for a second. Okay, yes. I want to talk about the Queen's Gambit, which was so damn good. Oh my God, she won 11 awards. Good for her. Miss Anya Taylor-Joy, of course, is a joy to freaking watch. And she was also in a music video. Yeah, she was also in a music video by Hozier. Not a lot of people know this, so I will do the Lord's work and tell you today. Damn good acting. And you were just talking about how she may be considered, she has one of those like unconventionally attractive faces. Would you elaborate?
Yeah. I mean, she's not like what you would describe as a conventional beauty of the 90s onwards, you know? She's unique, but beautiful in a way.
Hell yeah.
Interesting. Like, you can't take your eyes off of her. That kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Know?
Love that shit. Coconuts turns 10. Started from flat in Bangkok and now we're here all across Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. delivering a decade's worth of weird and wondrous stories. Thanks for the support. To celebrate, we're doing a massive giveaway and you'll want to head to coconuts.co for more details. In our top stories of the week, we start off in Bali, where an Indonesian influencer was arrested for masturbating live on social media.
Ooh la la.
I mean, do you, sister, get the bag. There is demand, right? If you can do this kind of thing, good for you.
Yeah, well, sex work positivity doesn't exist in Indonesia, so...
That sucks, but also, okay. An Indonesian woman authorities describe as an influencer was arrested in Denpasar for alleged pornographic action, which police said involved live streaming obscene acts on social media for money. Are you jealous? Are you guys just mad that you can't do it? But yes, it's me being salty. Denpasar police spokesman Iketut Sukadi said the suspect, identified as 22-year-old RR, has been going live on a social media app called Mango Live for the past 9 months.
Have you heard of that app?
I have not, but incredible name. I would think you used
yeah,
to buy
I think it's just one of those apps. Yeah, I think it's just one of those apps where women go nude and get tips.
Oh, kind of like OnlyFans or some shit?
No, but like live.
Oh, so like a Twitch streamer, but live.
But yeah, so she's picking the mangoes. Mangoes being a figurative term for digital coin, I guess.
Love that shit.
You know. Yeah, go on.
Oh, damn. Our boy Sukadi said this in a press conference.
The profit you gained from the live job is approximately 30 million rupiah.
That's around 2,104 USD. And every time she goes live, she gets about 1.5 million rupiah, which is around 105 USD. Get the bag, sis. I mean, like, is there anything to be mad about? You're just mad that you're not earning that. That is my takeaway.
Well, police have other means of income, so.
You know, their salaries, that's definitely what we're referring to. Absolutely.
Yep.
Cool. Nice. According to reports, RR was arrested for appearing naked in live streaming sessions. Online, she uses an account named Kuda Pony, meaning pony horse. And reportedly cute. Has thousands of followers. Exactly. That is a cute ass name.
She should have gone with Twilight Sparkle.
Oh my gosh. Or, yeah. What are the other people called? Rainbow Dash?
Rainbow Dash, yeah.
My little pony, my little pony. What is friendship all about?
If she's like the kind to rush.
Fucking shit.
Did I go too far?
I hate being here.
I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Keep going.
It took me a while, but okay. Fucking hell. I'm going to church right after this episode. Anyway, when she goes live, police said that she would often be seen masturbating in front of her audience. So RR was arrested in an apartment in Denpasar last week. She has been charged with violation of articles under the 2008 Pornography Law and the Information and Electronic Transactions Act, which carry a maximum sentence of 12 years in prison. Free her! Free Miss Pony.
Yeah, hope she's okay. Like, jokes aside.
Yeah, dude.
This is a ridiculous law.
Uh-huh. Are you going to arrest the people who subscribed, who tuned in live, huh?
No, that's not what the law covers.
That's some bullshit.
It's the porn creators that get it here.
Boo.
Yeah. And speaking of sex work, in Bangkok, arrest of Thai OnlyFans porn couple sparks online fury. The internet was at its wit's end after the same Thai police who shield murderers in their ranks, shoot protesters, and take an apathetic view of sexual violence swooped in to arrest an OnlyFans creator and her boyfriend. Furious condemnations poured in online over the arrest of Sukanya, a 19-year-old woman better known as Kai Now, and her 20-year-old boyfriend Karakot at a hotel in Southeast Metro Bangkok. They were charged with producing and distributing obscene content, according to Major General Karn Pong Chairungrung of Cybercrime Investigation Bureau. Huh. Such a dramatic show of Thai police. What do Thai people benefit from this? Tweeted activist Tanawat Ball Wong Chai. The couple only made some sexual content on OnlyFans, they didn't kill anyone. How about other rape cases? Have police caught the rapists yet? Come on, Thai police. Let's be serious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty fucked up that they're actually pursuing this, because if convicted, the couple could face up to 3 years in prison and a 60,000 baht fine, which amounts to around $1,800.
What?
And people condemned the police for making a big deal of pornography instead of prosecuting more serious crimes. It was only recently that Colonel Sirwat Deepwar, spokesman for the Royal Thai Police, came out to warn the public that people who identify themselves as pornhubbers or sex creators would face a stiff, no pun intended, penalty for persuading others to engage in sexual activity and violating the Computer Crime Act, which has become a sweeping catch-all law used to prosecute everyone doing things the state doesn't like. So this is exactly like the Bali story you just read out earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wait, but this bit, so the people who identify themselves as pornhubbers or sex creators, so what if you don't identify yourself? You wear a Kim Kardashian at the Met Gala type style of mask. Would that help? Would you not get arrested then? Many questions.
I guess not. If they can't point you to point your video to directly to you, I don't think. You know, I know some Indonesian OnlyFans creators deliberately obscure their face to avoid, you know, falling foul of the pornography laws.
Love that. Life hacks.
Yeah, but faceless sex acts probably don't sell as much, you know? So that's okay, the trade-off.
But maybe that's a kink, you know?
Yeah, for some people, maybe. For some people, yeah.
Just trying to find the silver lining. Over in Hong Kong, love napping on the bus. A Hong Kong travel agency has a tour for that now.
What the hell?
Sign me up. What the hell? I say that, but actually I have motion sickness, but never mind. But yes, falling into deep, uninterrupted sleep on a bus as the city rolls by and waking up refreshed and ready to take on the rest of the day is a pleasure like few others. And now you can sign up to do exactly that. And of course, you know, you get to do like, it's like some main character vibes, you know, where you stay out a window with your iPod in and then you look out and pretend you're in a music video.
No. Is that something you do?
That shit's universal. Just go and Google that shit, man.
Okay. Sorry.
No, I'm just kidding. Maybe it's not universal and maybe I'm insane. Anyway, a local travel agency introduced what it calls Hong Kong's first sleeping bus tour. This is a 6-hour excursion that will take the worn and weary on a drawn-out scenic drive through the New Territories and Lantau Island. Offered by Ulu Travel, the tour features a 76km bus route, which the agency brags is the longest in Hong Kong. And they might also be right, because according to the Hong Kong Bus Fandom Database, there's a Hong Kong Bus Fandom Database.
Yeah, haven't you read it?
I have not. I'm dumb. The longest daytime bus route is the E43 airport bus at 68.4 km. So this shit beats it. Okay, go on a long ass sleep around the island. Who knows?
And miss all this scenery.
Hell yeah. Look at all the scenery you won't see. Love it. So it starts at 99 Hong Kong dollars. That is about 13 USD. And the bus tour begins at Sun Wan. And it'll make photo stops at the aircraft maintenance area in Chek Lap Kok and Inspiration Lake near Disneyland before ending at Sun Wan West. Tourists can, of course, choose to skip the stops and sleep the whole way through. Thank you for reminding us of that. For 129 Hong Kong dollars, that is about 16 USD, Ulu Travel offers the zero decibel cabin on the bus's upper deck, promising a quiet environment for those who really want some shut eye. I love it.
This is also counterintuitive. I don't get this.
Why not, though? Because it's like, you definitely make sure that people shut the fuck up. I guess all the noisy baby section is downstairs. This is
no, I mean, the whole idea of this existing, like...
Oh, the whole sleeping bus thing?
Yeah, which has photo stops.
I mean, to be fair, Hong Kong houses are real freaking small, so this might be a fun way to, you know, not be at home.
Avoid people?
Yeah, I mean, that is...
Avoid the wife for like 6 hours?
Hell yeah. You pissed her off. Now you go on the damn bus.
Yeah. Okay, I see it now.
Yeah.
Apologies, Ulu Travel.
You're good. So our boy Frankie Chow, who's the founder of Ulu Travel, told Coconuts this. A friend said that because of work and family-related stress, he's not able to get a good night's sleep at home. yet he finds that he can sleep well on the bus. So you know how we rock babies at night? So maybe like the gentle hum of the bus's engine will slowly lull you to sleep.
The background noise as well.
That should be on the brochure right there. White noise comes free.
Comes with.
Yeah, man. And of course, it looks like it's freaking successful because in less than a day, more than half the spots for the event have already been sold. What? And if it proves popular, the founder also said that the agency might roll out more sleeping bus tours. And of course, the tour also includes lunch at Sun Wan before setting off to induce a food coma. They've thought of everything.
Yeah.
But yes, there are also bathroom stops along the way. But I don't know, what if you sleep through a bathroom stop and then you have to go and then your poo is like hanging on your butt and then you got to wait until the next one? Yeah, I don't know.
Sounds funny. Your imagination, man.
I'm just thinking of everything, you know.
Okay. That is actually a nice segue into our next story.
I'm glad.
In Coconuts, Jakarta, let me read you the headline. Graft convict smears feces on face of blasphemy suspect in Indonesian jail. Ew. So you know how you've always wondered where blasphemers stand in the hierarchy of prisoners?
Always. Every day.
Always, right? Well, apparently very low. Lower than corrupt officials.
What?
So there's a former police general named Napoleon Bonaparte. That is seriously his name. Wait, he's serving a 4-year sentence for receiving a bribe at the National Police's Crime Investigation Agency holding facility in East Jakarta. Among the fresh detainees at the facility is Mohammed Kache, who was arrested last month in Bali after he posted a sermon video in which he allegedly insulted Islam's prophet Muhammad. That is literally the worst thing you can do in Indonesia.
Oh, no.
So Napoleon, who is a Muslim, seemed keen to put Kache in his place after the former allegedly assaulted the latter in the most demeaning fashion imaginable. So, quoting General Crimes Unit Director Andy Rianjayadi, the face and body of the victim were smeared with human excrement by the perpetrator, that being Napoleon. He was referring to an assault complaint filed by Kache against the little conqueror. And in case you were wondering where Napoleon got the poo from, Andy said that he prepared his own feces to smear on Kache, adding that the former police general also punched the alleged blasphemer numerous times, apparently in the face as well.
Nice.
And, you know, Napoleon actually owned up to doing this. He did not shy away from the allegations, and he penned an open letter published via his lawyer saying that he would do anything to defend his religion. To quote what he wrote, "Anyone can insult me, but not my Allah, Quran, Holy Prophet, and my Islamic faith, because I swear I will retaliate in a measured manner against those who dare to do so." Of course, he probably measured out his poo before actually flinging it and smearing it on the blasphemer, allegedly.
Like a Martha Stewart recipe.
Absolutely. And he went on to say, "I will take responsibility for all my actions against Kache, whatever the risk." So since then, I think he's been put in isolation, but this is Napoleon, that is, but no charges as of today. So, in case you're wondering what Napoleon is in for, he headed the National Police's Internal Relations Division in his heyday, and he was found guilty in March 2021 of receiving billions of rupiah in bribes from infamous corruption fugitive Joko Chandra in exchange for taking his name out of Interpol's red notice list. So yeah, he's no saint.
Well, shit. What's a resume?
Yeah. And Kache, he may face up to 6 years in prison for alleged violations of articles on blasphemy and disinformation under the Criminal Code and the Information and Electronic Transactions Act. In a YouTube video that circulated widely in the world's largest Muslim-majority nation, Kache was said to have insulted Prophet Muhammad by implying that the founder of Islam was a disciple of the jinn, or supernatural creatures that are broadly understood as demonic spirits. Again, do not say that in Indonesia.
Oh, Lord.
Or you get poo on your face when you're in prison.
Mm-hmm. What a no-shit moment.
Mm.
And we move over to KL, where Malaysia is among the 55 countries where authorities investigate social media posts. Oh, hey, neighbor, same. No, I didn't say that. Anyway. But yeah, Malaysia has been listed as one of the 55 countries where people have been investigated, arrested, and even convicted over social media posts. The country scored 58 out of 100 points for internet freedom in a report produced by American think tank Freedom House, the same as last year. The social media platforms Malaysian authorities targeted were Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok, all the fun ones. And between June 2020 and May, the Freedom on the Net report marked Malaysia for blocking political, social, or religious content, allowing pro-government commentators to manipulate online discussions, imposing a new law or directive that increased online censorship, and detaining someone over political or social content. Malaysia also became one of the 24 countries that initiated measures governing how platforms treat content, including requirements to remove posts containing issues linked to race, religion, and the monarchy, according to the report. The internet is considered partly free in Malaysia, unlike in other neighboring countries such as Thailand, Myanmar, and Vietnam, where internet usage is controlled. In the past year, Malaysian police have made multiple arrests over social media posts, including political satirist Fahmi Reza and a man who tweeted about the royal family. News portal Malaysia Kini in February was found guilty of contempt of court over reader comments on its site and fined a hefty 500,000 ringgit. That's about 124,000 USD. So,
Damn! Yeah, like, even more disturbing, there's an even more recent story in which, like, the Malaysian PM's name was trending on Twitter. And apparently, like, all the tweets were negative, but when you click on the hashtag, nothing pops up in Malaysia.
They have
that kind of power. Holy shit. And over in Coconuts, Manila, we asked the question, so what was so bad about martial law? So September 21st marked the 49 years after former president and dictator Ferdinand Marcos signed Proclamation 1081, effectively declaring martial law in the Philippines. This began a period of authoritarian rule marked by the death of press freedom, widespread human rights violations, and plunder, all par for the course in our little region. Despite these transgressions being widely recorded, myths about martial law continue to perpetuate, tarnishing the memory of those who have suffered under the period and distorting the truths about how the country has suffered during this dark regime. And here, a quick reminder of how bad martial law was during the time. Under martial law, 70,000 were detained, 34,000 were tortured, and 3,240 were killed by the military and police. These figures from Amnesty International show that the regime was rife with human rights violations, including 70,000 incarcerations, many of them warrantless due to the writ of habeas corpus being suspended, 34,000 documented tortures, over 3,200 extrajudicial killings, and 77 disappearances. Also, 6 out of 10 Filipinos were poor during martial law. Contrary to revisionists' claim that the Philippines was in its golden age during the time, poverty became more widespread under Marcos. When Marcos took office, 4 out of 10 Filipinos were poor. This number rose to 6 out of 10 by the end of his rule, according to the Martial Law Museum. And the country's debt rose to $28.86 billion. Again, debunking the myth that the country was in its golden economic years under Marcos, the country's international debt rose from $0.36 billion in 1961 to $28 billion in 1986, a massive burden that Filipinos continue to pay for to this day. And during that time, 464 media outlets were closed after martial law was declared. On September 22, 1972, Marcos ordered the military to take over the assets of major media outlets. 6 days later, Marcos ordered the Department of National Defense to sequester the facilities of ABS-CBN and ABC. A total of 464 media outlets were closed after the declaration of martial law, according to the Inquirer archives, including church publications. So yeah, we hope this has refreshed your memory. Today is a good day to pick up a book, hear the stories of the victims during this time, and say hashtag never again.
Oof.
Yep, just the hallmark of a country run by a dictator. We have exactly the same issue in Indonesia. Oof. With the New Order regime under President Suharto, who served for 30 years, and now the exact same thing is happening in Indonesia. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Over in Singapore, you people have to quit clowning. This school is sorry for terrorizing Singapore with child luring clowns. Whoever thought of this shit, you need to reflect, so. Singapore remained on high alert over an infestation of predatory clowns preying on its children after an education center apologized.
Fucking spooky.
Oh no! Speech Academy Asia, what is you doing? They apologize for sending in people dressed as clowns to loiter outside primary schools and lure students to follow them. An idea so freaking terrible that it's difficult to imagine how it got so far. God bless. There were no people with brains in that room when this was decided. That is the alternate headline. Anyway,
they're probably high on kratom.
Oh, it's illegal. All we got is Chupa Chups. So, yeah.
Yeah,
it's no, definitely right. That. Oh, yeah. The sugar content in there, Jesus. Mm. So the center had this to say in an online statement. We understand parents' concerns for their safety and well-being of their children. Please do allow us to apologize for the inconvenience caused. Adding that they're currently in the midst of discussion to rectify the clownery. Our words, not theirs. The clownery bit. But yeah, what the hell? Police said that several reports had been filed, although, you know, they didn't name the education center being investigated. But of course, people on the internet are real smart, real fast, and they found out it was Speech Academy Asia, which has several locations as being behind the scourge of clowns that have been coming around often. Not since 2016 has the unfunny terror of roving clowns gripped the fucking internet. Oh my God, remember those days? In one photo that raised alarm online, a person in a Brit plaid shirt with a hat that looked left over from a 90s rave slouched outside Bedok's Temasek Primary School.
I love that description.
Thank you.
And that's pretty terrifying.
It. Yep. Whoever wrote this, amazing stuff. Even Speaker of the Parliament, Tan Chuan Jin, had this to say. Whoever is doing what I assume to be some viral marketing nonsense, stop it! Exclamation mark. So I had to yell it out. And he also went on to say, please remind your children, do not follow them and to report to the police. It's not amusing and just plain dangerous. Hello, what the hell?
There isn't a new It movie around the corner, is there?
Right, I was wondering, like guerrilla marketing for some other stupid ass movie. I mean, I liked it, but it wasn't scary. I laughed through the whole thing, but that's me.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tao Nan School at Marine Crescent also sent a letter warning parents of the clown menace and encourage them to report any encounters to the authorities. Oof. In the letter, it said, police has alerted that there are persons dressed as clowns seen loitering around primary schools and requesting them to follow them. Please remind your child not to be lured by any strangers and keep the school informed or call the police immediately if your child spots any suspicious characters around the school premises. After the story was published, Speech Academy Asia confirmed that the act was part of a marketing roadshow and the person pictured was an employee. No children were harmed, according to them. And they said, we truly understand your concern for the safety of your children. Hence, we will be putting an immediate stop to our roadshows. Roadshows? You're going to call it roadshows?
Yeah, they were high. Seriously, like, how did they not think about this, all the implications?
I know, like everybody in the room, you are a dumbass and you are not worthy to be a marketer. It's just my little baby opinion, but you know.
Boom. And then Coconuts Yangon. Something quite positive for a change. although still kind of tinged with sadness. Myanmar actress held by junta wins best performance at German Film Fest.
Yay!
So a Burmese actress won an award at an international film festival in Germany, despite the fact that she and almost everyone else who worked on the Myanmar film, which premiered there, is in military custody or on the run. Ah, damn.
Goddamn.
Ayandra Kiao Zin was not present to receive her award at the Oldenburg Film Festival. Neither was any of the cast or crew of their film, which premiered there, titled What Happened to the Wolf? Director Nagi and his wife Pan Pyo Too, who starred, are in hiding as fugitives of the military dictatorship. So is actor Ong Myint Myat. We celebrate her elegance, her soul, and her invaluable gift to cinema with hope that this reaches her. It is our honor to present this award to Ayandra Kiao Zin, said Canadian actress Deborah Kara Unga, who was overcome with emotion as she presented the award. And it was accepted by a friend of the director. Not only is the film's depiction of LGBT romance transgressive in culturally conservative Myanmar, but the filmmakers and performers have been branded enemies of the state for their advocacy to return power to civilian hands. Their absence was noted by festival director Torsten Neumann when the film premiered there. It is a beautiful film, and the director Nagi and his wife had to hide because they're being blackmailed by the military junta for stepping up and fighting for the democracy that has been taken away from the country, said Neumann, who, along with others, wore t-shirts emblazoned with Ayandra Kiao Zin's name. And this beautiful actress that I wear on my t-shirt tonight is in prison, and nobody knows how she's doing, he said. Just a year ago, director Na Yi was leading the Rating System Now campaign. Now he and Pang Pyo Too, who also appeared in his award-winning 2018 debut, Me, are among dozens of celebrities forced into hiding after the junta accused them of defamation. Ayandra Kiao Zin, one of Myanmar's highest-paid actresses with two Myanmar Academy Awards under her belt, was arrested in April along with her actor husband, Pyai Ti Oo, for participating in anti-coup protests. The film follows terminally ill patients Wei, who's portrayed by Pang Pyo Too, and Mo, who's portrayed by Ayandra Kiao Zin, who meet in a hospital. They find comfort in each other and ultimately embark on a road trip together to a Shan state destination famous for its sea of clouds. Oh, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Fans showed their support for the two leading ladies. So yeah, more sadness for Myanmar.
But you're right. There is a tinge of sadness, but it's kind of happy for a change, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, at least their plight is being, you know, even more widely recognized if it isn't already. But it seems like the international world isn't really doing enough anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oof. And our guest for this week, he is none other than Jeremy Wade, who is a world-renowned angler and adventurer whose 40-year-long career
proves that good things come to those who bait.
Pause for laughter.
I'm going to slap whoever wrote that.
Good thing it's not me. But yeah. We had a chance to talk to him, and it was real fun.
Yeah, he's such a cool dude. So we're keeping it real with Jeremy Wade. We catch up with a world-renowned angler and adventurer whose 40-year-long career proves that good things come to those who bait. Apologies for all the puns there, Jeremy, but my producer made me say all of that.
Okay, I've not heard that one before. I'll make a note of that. Yeah.
So I'm just going to jump in, sorry again, with questions. So it's fair to say that yours is not a conventional lifestyle. So did you choose the river monster hunter life, or did that life choose you?
It was incredibly haphazard, and I take far more than 20 minutes sort of explaining all the twists and turns. But, you know, a lot of things come down to sort of lucky breaks at certain times. Um, I, I, I used to go fishing when I was a kid in England, and that sort of, you know, it was a big adventure. But then, you know, we are a crowded island. There's not a lot of water. There's quite a lot of people. And I saw an article, quite a long time now ago, about a fish in India. And I took myself to India when I was in my mid-20s. I didn't have much idea what I was doing, but I managed to catch a fish there called a marsia. I wrote a couple of articles about it. And at that point, I just had this idea, maybe I can combine my interest with some kind of job. Incidentally, I'm still waiting to be paid for one of those articles. So, you know, it wasn't a brilliant start. That was about 1982, I think. But it sort of gradually, from then, I just traveled to different places, and I got this idea gradually that a lot of the things I was seeing, I wasn't seeing on TV. But then I think most people have this question, you know, how do you get something on TV if you don't come from that background, if you don't know the right people? So it took, you know, there were a lot of false starts, but In the end, I met the right people, and it was originally just going to be one program, and it just went on from there. I think the interesting thing about freshwater fish didn't strike me really at the beginning is, you know, there has been so much good natural history TV being done over the last few decades, but the one group of creatures that haven't been featured is freshwater fish, and the reason for that is, a lot of fresh water, you don't have good visibility. So you can send the best underwater camera person into that water, and they're not going to find anything. So you've got to find a different way of actually showing these creatures. And what I use normally is a fishing line, but that's because they're, you know, a lot of the time there's no other way to show them. So I don't really see them as fishing programs. It is revealing what's under the water and
discovery.
Yes, it's exactly. Yeah. It's another world there. And I mean, you know, here's an interesting fact. I mean, and it's been very good to me over the years, because there is so much there. The amount of fresh water in the world, you know, it's a tiny fraction of the volume of water that's in the oceans, tiny, tiny fraction, sort of less than 0.01%. And yet the number of fish species is about the same as what you've got in the sea. You know, you've got such diversity of habitat. So once we found a way to serve that up on TV, there was just so much material there. So that's, you know, I'm very, well, if somebody had told me when I started off in TV that I'd still be doing it now, I would have been very surprised. But, but you know, that richness of, you know, that rich seam of material is one of the reasons.
Mm. And that sounds like a very dangerous lifestyle as well. You've done so many cool things. How many close shaves with death have you had?
Well, you know, the edited highlights, some of those are a bit hair-raising, but I mean, that's spread over quite a long time now. And, you know, of course, when we're doing a film shoot, it has to be risk assessed within an inch of its life, you know, otherwise we're not going to get insurance and all the rest of it. But I suppose what we're trying to do is we're going into challenging environments, and there is a line, you know, what we try and do is get as close to that line as we can, obviously without crossing it. And that can sometimes, that can sometimes get a little bit interesting. Some people have this idea that I'm reckless. I'm not. I mean, it's all about, it is very much about doing your homework. It's about being aware of the risks and being able to sort of keep yourself safe. And because they're about fish, and some of those fish are potentially dangerous, it's about how you deal with those fish. I mean, something like a bull shark, for example. I mean, if your hand was in the wrong place for a matter of a second or so, you would lose your hand, you know. But that's an obvious thing. Keep your hands away from its mouth. But it's the things. So I think with the fish, I know what I'm doing. I'm pretty well prepared. Okay, I've got a director, often a cameraman, talking to me while I'm trying to focus on what I'm doing. But it's more the things that just come out of the environment that are things like the weather. I was filming in Suriname a few years ago, and there'd been this big storm in the morning on the river. The storm had moved on. We'd gone out. We were filming. And it was literally a bolt from the blue. There was a flash of lightning, and our sound recorders was actually hit. And we're suddenly in a bit of a medical emergency. Luckily, he was okay. Personally, I suppose that the most dramatic thing that's happened to me is I was the very first time I was filming in the Amazon, which is now nearly 20 years ago. We were doing some aerial filming, and our plane crashed. So we. When we actually had a camera, we had three cameras on board. Two of them were destroyed, but one of them kept rolling. So we filmed the whole thing from inside the plane, which is, I think that was a first, and I don't think anyone's done that since. Wouldn't want to repeat that, but that was, a close shave. We very luckily all walked away without a scratch. I say luckily. Wow. Also, the pilot was incredibly skillful. Pilot managed to stall it in the crown of a tree, which then snapped, and it's big story there. But yes, that I think is the highlight's probably the wrong word, but that's the one that stands out.
Yeah, I remember being pretty blown away reading about those stories and hearing it directly from you. It's quite something else. But taking it back to our region and Southeast Asia, we also read that you were arrested on suspicions of being an international spy. What happened, and how was that resolved?
That was a very long story. That was in Thailand. That was in 1984. This is a tricky one. I don't know that I don't know I should say too much about this. I was going fishing on the Mekong River on the border with Laos, as it was then. And I had letters of introduction. That was a bit crazy at the time. But I later found out through I came across some articles. I was basically in an area of Thailand with a camera and a notebook, saying that I was looking for fish. It always sounds like a very unlikely cover story. I mean, in the Amazon, people just go, "You're looking for gold, aren't you? Where's your? Can we look in your back? Can we see what kind of gun you've got?" They always want to look in my rucksack, which is full of fishing gear. They want to know what kind of guns I've got. But in the case of Thailand, I found out years later that there was stuff going on in that part of Thailand that no one was ever supposed to find out about. And by the time they did, nobody cared. But it was all to do with Khmer Rouge and stuff like that.
You don't have to be specific. Don't worry.
Okay, then moving on to another greatest hit, if you will. You also caught cerebral malaria in the Congo. Could you tell us more about that then?
Yeah, here's an interesting thing. As before I was on TV, I was a journalist of sorts, and I used to travel quite a bit. And a lot of the traveling that I did was very uncomfortable, and that involved getting ill. But the great thing about being a journalist, maybe you have some experience of this, is that when stuff happens which is bad, there's part of you that is just wants it to be over, wants to be comfortable again. There's another part of you, I suppose I'm almost like a split personality. There's part of me thinking, this is great material. How many other people have experienced this? So in that case, at first, I actually thought the symptoms were so weird that I thought it was heat stroke to start with. But then the symptoms settled into something. I was also taking all the medication. So in theory, a lot of people think you take the medication, you're not going to get it, but you can. And that got so bad. Let me see. I was almost losing my vision. I had complete whiteout. What would happen would be at the end of the day, this is on the equator. You're right on the equator there. At the end of the day, I would just get really, really cold, and I would just wrap myself in all my clothes, and I would just shiver. And then I would wake up in the night, and I would be, I know that there are cases of malaria, people still catch it in Singapore, don't they? I would just be, unbelievably hot. And I'd actually sort of take off all my clothes and just stand outside radiating heat. But also, of course, doing that, I'm this mosquito magnet. In the end, I treated it and got rid of it. But it was a very, it lasted for something like 10 days, and it was very unpleasant, scary, And like I say, it was actually the almost, you know, becoming blind. And there was one point actually, and again, you know, you mentioned sort of near-death experiences. There was one point where I was traveling on a boat. It was actually a log raft floating down the river. And we had to get off that and get on a truck. The truck then broke down. And I was so low that I actually had this feeling, you know, if I could just crawl under a bush and lie down and go to sleep and never wake up, that's fine by me. You know, it was, you know, things were that bad. And that's an interesting experience, you know, being that close to giving up. But like I say, there's part of me that's just going, oh, this is great. You know, you've got to write about it. You know, you've got to write about this sometime or whatever.
So, you know, despite all the risks, you've been in the business of making documentaries for a long time now. People mostly know you through River Monsters, which ran from 2009 to 2017. Mm. Again, you probably touched on this a little bit, but I want to dig in a little bit more into what is it that keeps you going, that you're braving all of this?
Yeah, I think it is curiosity. I mean, it is the fact that there is this other world under the surface. It's quite, you know, it can be quite close to us, but it's this alien environment, and it's a bit of a cliche. You hear people talking about the seafloor. You know, we know less about the seafloor than we do about the surface of Mars or whatever. You know, it is. Here we are in the 21st century. Water is this very, you know, it is this fascinating medium. We can't really see into it. We can sort of see into it indirectly. You know, I often think I'm looking at a bit of river or a lake, and I'm thinking, wouldn't it be amazing if you could sort of magically almost remove the water visually and just see what's down there, see all the fish? But with all our technology today, we still can't do that. We can sort of get approximations of it with sonar and stuff like that. And the other thing is, though, there's part of me that doesn't want to do that. You know, I sort of don't want to completely demystify it. So I think, yeah, it is this thing that I encountered when I was a kid. You know, I'm pulling out, you know, back then it was my first fish was just a few inches long. But it's like, here is this inhabitant of another universe. And there's other stuff down there. And here I am now, you know, half a century plus on from that. And I'm still discovering new things. And I think I worked as a teacher for a while. And I think a lot of things that you get excited about, a lot of the excitement is sharing that with other people. You know, I'm in a very privileged position in that I get to go to lots of amazing places, see lots of incredible things. And what adds to that is the, you know, having a great team of sort of TV professionals with me who can then, you know, serve that up and sort of educate and enlighten and entertain, give enjoyment to other people. It's really, you know, my teaching career was very short and not very successful, but in a sense now I'm sort of doing the same kind of thing but on a much bigger scale.
Right. Absolutely.
Oh yes, and of course you've returned. You're going to return with your new series, Unknown Waters, which premieres on National Geographic Asia on September 27th. Could you tell us what's new about the series?
Right. So yes, it's. Yeah, it's what we're doing now is, you know, what I'm doing now is sort of, you know, just move on a bit from River Monsters. It's what one thing that really fascinates me is the different types of fish. You know, Unknown Waters, there are three programs. We've taken three fish: bull shark, Atlantic salmon, Nile perch. And I think when most people think of a fish, they think of a sort of generic, almost like a child's drawing of a fish. We all know what a general fish looks like. But when you look at them closely, there's all these variations. It's a bit like looking at cars or aircraft. You know, you look at aircraft, they're all, you know, there's a different design. And what can you tell when you look at that fish? You know, what does the way that it looks like tell you about its life? And what it also does, it sort of tells you about the place where it lives. So I suppose, you know, what I'm reaching towards at the moment is almost telling the story of places through the fish that live there. And also into that picture comes the people as well, because people, you know, there's often a strong relationship between the people and the fish. You know, the human culture is all tied in with this. So it's quite ambitious, and I think the whole thing is a bit of a work in progress, but it's a very interesting direction that we're now moving in. And it's, you know, I wouldn't say we've got it right first time, but I think, you know, that there's some very promising, you know, stuff there. And, you know, the people who've seen the programs already, you know, tend to like them. So it's, I suppose it's a sort of, you know, it's always very difficult to categorize things. I've always resisted this thing of, you know, River Monsters being a fishing show. It's not, you know, it's about fish. It's not really a fishing show. But I'd say, it's, you know, it's possibly it's moving more into sort of, you know, more into sort of like a travel show. But I mean, it's always been a bit of a travel show. It's a hybrid. You know, it's always been a hybrid. It's just the, you know, the DNA. We're just trying to sort of evolve it a little bit, I guess. You know, into a more interesting area.
Sounds good. Okay. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. Seems like we have to wrap up. There are many more things we'd love to ask you, but I guess I have to pick one. So that being, you know, you've been in the business 40 years. So what comes after Unknown Waters? Are you looking to pass on the baton or the rod, so to speak, eventually?
I don't know. I think... What I do is quite physically demanding, so I've got to think of my own, you know, my fitness is starting to decline, unfortunately, but I can still, you know, I can maybe get people to sort of not carry me around. I think I'm going to be mobile for a little bit longer, but yeah, I suppose I have got a bit of a sense of urgency. There's still stories out there that I want to tell, and what I want to do is to continue moving in the area that I, you know, in the direction that I was just talking about. One thing that I'm very pleased about is that I do get this sense that sort of worldwide across our audience, people have really woken up to, you know, it was this very neglected area of the natural world. I think the oceans, people have a lot of knowledge, a lot of material about the oceans, but the freshwater habitat is very important. There's lots there. It's very important for our own health. You know, we all depend on drinking water, clean rivers. And I think I will, you know, there's already more interest. And I think what I and the people I work with have done over the past years has sort of put some momentum into this. And there's other stuff happening. And so I think it's just, yeah, it's just keep that momentum going for as long as possible, really.
Yep, we love that. And yeah, we can't wait to actually watch Unknown Waters with Jeremy Wade. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for your time.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Nice to meet you too.
Okay.
Okay. Wow, that was really that was quite a fascinating interview. I wish we had more than 20 minutes with Jeremy Wade, but of course he's a busy man leading a very busy and very interesting life. He's such a cool presence. It's pretty incredible. Like, what is he, like 60 or so now? You know, if I lead half a life half of as interesting as his, I'd die a happy man.
Right. I like how he was just like, you know, he says things casually. The same way you and I would talk about going to the supermarket is the same way he would say, oh, no big deal. I just got lost in the Amazon one time. Got like cerebral malaria. No big deal.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just one of those Monday things.
Yeah. And we actually had a quick chat with him after the interview. He's such a lovely man. And he confessed his love of durian to us.
A man with taste.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's all the time we have this week. We'll catch you in the next one.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to support Coconuts and our weird and wondrous stories, you can become a Coco Plus member at coconuts.co/membership. Make a patron payment at coconuts.co/patron or buy a fresh merch at the coconut shop at shop.coconuts.co.
Need something to go on your head? How about your wall? We've just dropped some limited edition exclusive merch for our 10th anniversary. Check them out at shop.coconuts.co.
Subscribe to the podcast and leave reviews. Tell us how you feel and what you like and don't like. We're excited to hear from you. The Coconuts Podcast delivers impactful, weird, and wondrous reporting by a journalist on the ground in 8 cities: Singapore, Bangkok, Hong Kong, Manila, Jakarta, Kuala Lumpur, Yangon, and Bali. Listen to headline news and insightful interviews on matters large and small, designed for people located in or curious about Southeast Asia and Hong Kong.
The Coconuts Podcast is a Coconuts Media production. Our hosts are Sarma Lee and Andre Nasri. Our executive producer is Byron Perry. Our production manager is Clarissa Cortez, and our editor is Paul Medina.